I am your host, your friend, fellow horror enthusiast, Bruce Marvel, and this is a very exciting episode for me, which will air later. But with me is renowned author, and he's basically like a horror legend hunter at this point. He is none other than Christopher Rondina. I pronounce that right?
Yep, Rondina. Okay. Good Italian name.
Oh, there you go. There you go. See, I like you even more. So I'm kind of taking that, even though you base more of your stuff in like actually history and, nonfiction, I guess, it does all kind of relate back to like horror. It's always vampires and Dracula and stuff like, so is that rooted in like a love for the horror genre?
Huge horror fan. I mean, I grew up in New England, and we're, ghost stories are kind of our bread and butter here. So I grew up in a very small neighborhood that had one of those old like cemeteries with stones dating back to the 1700s. You climb over an old stone wall through a bunch of brambles, and there's an old cemetery back there. So I grew up just loving that stuff. I love spooky stuff my entire life. And vampires, werewolves, all the classic monsters have been like the core of my heart since I was a kid. So it just grew out of that I became a horror writer, a nonfiction horror writer, because I thought that the best part about so many of these great old legends is that there's often truth behind them.
Yeah, and we will so get to that, because like I said, I read we have a mutual acquaintance. He's actually a very dear friend of mine, and I hope he sees this. I've actually been trying to get him on the show for a long time, but I gotta get him out of his house for a good 6 to 8 hours, and we're gonna talk Dracula when I finally do. But Neil Vokes, he actually gave me Hunting Dracula.
That was, I tell you, that was such a fun book to write. I had gone to Transylvania about 25, almost 30 years ago, prior to writing my very first book, which was on vampire folklore. And for years and years, I'd wanted to write a book specifically about Dracula. So a little over a year ago, I had the opportunity to travel to Whitby, England, which also, of course, features in the novel, and to kind of bookend my Dracula travels. And so I finally decided it was about time to do it. And so I was very, very lucky to get both Neil and Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy, to both contribute some custom art to the book. And I've been a big fan of both of them for years. But I first discovered Neil back in the 80s when he was drawing for Fright Night, the original Fright Night comic based on the movie. And I loved his artwork back then, and was super lucky to connect with him, and he's been great. I mean, he literally said after we did the Dracula book, I told him I was thinking of working on a werewolf book, and he said, just promise me the cover on that one. So we that's how that came to pass.
We'll get to that one too. That's next on like my actual reading list. So after I finished this, and just to kind of, and if I'm wrong in any way, please correct me, but what I loved about this book and what I found so fascinating is like for the longest time, a lot of people just kind of wrote Bram Stoker off as someone who, a lot of people kind of said he ripped off Polidori to come up with his story. A lot of people were saying, he just happened to really come across the name Dracula, like kind of like luck. You actually prove in this novel that he did quite a lot of research, and he pulled a lot of from like real truth and folklore, and actually from real true spots. One of my favorite parts of the book is where, obviously when they find the ship, the Demeter crashed, and the big black dog who they kind of think could be a wolf comes out of the ship and runs away. That's actually based on a real myth in that part of the world.
Yeah, the Dmitri was a Russian schooner that actually crashed in Whitby Harbor in 1885, and so it was still fairly recent events when Stoker went to Whitby in the 1890s and started writing Dracula. So it was really fresh on people's minds, and almost all of the story of Dracula has these little sort of kernels of real events that brought them to pass. Whether it's the inspiration of Vlad III of Romania, who was the partial inspiration for Dracula, whether it was the story of the Dmitri, Lucy Westerner being based possibly on a real American vampire folklore, all these little nuggets of history created the story, which I think is wonderful. I think that it's fun because it brings so much of the story to life.
It does. And you know what? So I've read Dracula twice. I read it many years ago, and I was kind of too young to really appreciate it. And then it's funny because I kind of read this right at the same time that The Last Voyage of the Demeter movie was coming out, and it inspired me to reread Dracula the book, and it actually gave me more like your story, your nonfiction work actually gave me more appreciation for Bram Stoker and actually more appreciation for the book when I read it the second time. So
And The Last Voyage of the Demeter, it's such a shame that the film didn't do well in theaters. And I think possibly
it
it's because
is.
people, the name didn't necessarily, ring a bell with people, especially folks who hadn't read the original novel. But it's such a great film. I mean, it's a classic horror monster movie, and really, it's scary, and they don't make a lot of scary Dracula movies. So I really wish more people had seen it.
I do too, and I'm hoping it's one of those movies that kind of did better, like when it came to rental and stuff like that. Because like you said, it's an awesome, great monster movie. The director who actually did one of his movies was, I believe, was The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which is a really, really creepy film.
Yeah, Andre Overdahl, and he's such a great director. He directed the adaptation of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which was such a fun movie,
That
and
was
maybe
a fun movie. Yeah, I was actually hoping we'd get another one. Then I'm hoping it's not dead.
I hope so too, because I think it would be fantastic. I love the fact that he uses practical effects. I don't have any problem with CGI, but the practical, monsters he uses look so good, and yeah. I've got my fingers crossed that we're going to get a Scary Stories too.
I hope so. I hope so. And I'm again, I'm way old school. I love the old practical effects. I grew up on the classics. Frankenstein monster being my favorite. And yet, I kind of feel like too with the like just real quick on The Last Voyage of the Demeter, I feel right now in our culture it's really hard. People just don't seem to have like interest in like period pieces
And that's such a
from that
shame too.
time.
Such a shame, because again, I love it. If you set something in the 18th century, set it in the 19th century, I'm going to be the first in line to go see it. One that, we can maybe talk about a little later, when we get into the werewolf subject. But did you ever see the movie The Cursed?
Oh,
Which
I love that movie.
yeah,
Yeah.
phenomenal film, which just again just vanished in theaters. I mean, I think 20 people went to see it, and it's such an excellent film with again an amazing, really different approach to the werewolf mythos, great looking
Yes.
monster, just a gorgeous atmospheric film. And I went to see it in the theater the night that it opened, and there were like three people, and there's such a shame.
And you're right. So when that movie came out, I was hearing all the buzz about it, and it has a great cast too.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And it never even came to a theater by me. But when it came out, I saw it, and I was like you said, I was blown away. I was like, what an original, different take
Really was, yeah.
werewolf war.
I love the fact that they went for an old school mystical approach, and the sort of gypsy lore and everything else that they connected to it. They just brought it back to it. It was like a great old universal horror film with modern sensibility and modern special effects, which again, I fell in love with it. I've probably watched it a dozen times.
It was definitely, if it wasn't my favorite horror movie to come out of 2021, I believe that was the year, like at least in the last couple of years, like that was definitely easily one of my most favorite horror movies to come out of that time. They could come out in like the last 5 years. And yeah, I do. If anyone watches this episode, I encourage everyone to watch it. And I tell people all the time, I said, like you said, the classics like Dracula and vampires and werewolves, I feel like Hollywood just doesn't know what to do
Agree.
anymore.
Yeah, I think that the slasher films and things like that, which can be great fun, they're not really my genre, but they can be great fun, especially if they're well done. But they've become so popular, I feel like people think that vampires and werewolves and the Frankenstein monster and stuff like that, it's just too old-fashioned for people. And it's a shame, because when these are well done, they can be outstanding films. Again, Last Voyage of the Demeter, what a great classic monster movie. But it's not tame at all. I mean, that thing, the monster in that movie, is genuinely scary. They explore Dracula's sort of demonic, monstrous side, and they do such a great job with it. It's claustrophobic. A lot of people have compared it to the movie Alien on a 19th century, sailing ship, and that's exactly how it plays out.
Yeah, and I would agree totally. Me and Neil went and saw that movie together, and Neil to me is you can't if you're talking vampires or Dracula, that's he's a walking Dracula film like anthology. I mean, the guy just knows his stuff, and if he's saying it's good,
I agree.
It
Yep.
looks good, yeah.
Yeah, he's a classic film, classic film aficionado too. And you know what? I feel like we're a dying breed, unfortunately. Again, the old Universal sort of the Universal ethos, the Hammer films and stuff like that. That's what we grew up on, And so, yeah, no, I wish that some of that would come back. And I think part of it for me too is, again, I'm a huge horror fan, but I think that gore ends up replacing story in so many films. Gore ends up they just think, how bloody can I make it? I used to be a dedicated reader of Fangoria magazine, but one of the things about Fangoria that used to irk me is that I get it, you're a horror magazine, but even on the most tame film imaginable, they would find the two shots that showed somebody with, something gouging out their eye, and that's the shots that they would use. And I was like, listen, gore's not a substitute for story. It's a tool to help you tell a scary story, but it doesn't have to take over a film. And I've seen scarier movies with not a drop of blood than the ones that have buckets of blood coming, through the windows. And so for me, usually the classic spooky horror is so much more effective for me than the more, limbs chopped off.
No, I agree. I totally agree. And I think what a lot of people, because I mean, so I'm a child of the 80s. So like slasher is kind of more like it's in my wheelhouse. But I, again, the first one of my fondest memories in the world is being maybe 5 years old and my dad showing me Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein for the first time. And
Phenomenal movie.
it's been my favorite movie ever since. And from that, so Boris Karloff wasn't even my first Frankenstein monster to say
Glenn Strange was an
Frankenstein.
amazing Frankenstein monster. I mean, the man was tall and he was gaunt. And it's funny, I think when we imagine that sort of stereotypical Frankenstein with the arms out, and everything else, we're usually thinking of Glenn Strange because he's the one who did that. Karloff didn't do that style of animation, but Glenn Strange played the Frankenstein monster in House of Frankenstein, in House of Dracula, in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And so he was one of the more, prolific actors to play the creature. And I think we see that tall, incredibly imposing monster. Karloff's portrayal was great, but it's a very sympathetic monster, and the monster's not really scary in the films, so I found Frankenstein terrifying when I was a kid, but it was that lumbering monster that Strange played that really kind of stuck with me.
And I really think, I mean, like obviously Frank, like Boris Korn coined the look, but I think the, if you ask anybody, the iconic image of Frankenstein monster, I think like more people would identify with the Glenn Strange looking one than they would
Absolutely.
Karloff one. And like to your point, even the old school slasher films, like if you go back, like I'll take Texas Chainsaw Massacre for an example, one of the great, one of the Mount Rushmores of like slasher films, if you even consider, like I consider it a slasher, but I mean,
Yeah, it
that's the
absolutely is.
movie you think blood and guts, but when you really go back and watch that movie, it's not that gory, it's what you don't see
Right.
that you
It's
take with
tension
you.
and it's suspense and things like that. Those are the things that make an effective film. Think about Halloween, the original 1978 Halloween. That has barely a drop of blood in it. Even the kills that you see are fairly tame kills, but Michael Myers is one of the most terrifying characters in the history of horror. I mean, not just slashers, but in horror in general. This wonderful, dead-eyed, shark-like, relentless killer. It didn't require gore, and again, with every successive movie, they upped the gore, reduced the tension, and then they just got silly, which is such a shame. I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street, the original film, I mean, that's a gory movie, but it's a scary movie, and Freddy was a scary killer at that point. He wasn't cracking jokes constantly, and I feel like they do that constantly to these horror characters. They defang them. They make them into these ridiculous caricatures of themselves before the films are even, through their course. But the originals of most of these are just untouchable to me.
They are. And like you said, another thing too, it's like I feel these movies, they actually had somewhat relatable, likable characters that you actually felt bad when like something happened to them. I feel like that's another thing really missing in today, especially like you talk about the slasher movies. They're already presenting you with characters that you kind of want the killer to kill off already.
Right. Somebody pointed out, years ago, and I thought it was a really interesting observation, that is that slasher films, even though a lot of times the most conservative voices are the ones who are speaking out against horror films, have a conservative moral bent to them, because usually it's the virginal good girl who survives until the end, and anybody who has sex in those movies, they're dead. They usually have the like they're usually smoking pot, they're drinking, they're doing drugs, they're having sex, and all of them get murdered. And it's the good girl who's sitting home reading a book and couldn't get a date is the one who always survives. So they have this like they really have this godly message of like sort of conservatism about them, which is I always thought that was a very funny fact.
Well, it was funny. Someone, I forget what it, I want to say, it was like one of the documentaries, like In Search of Darkness or something like that. But they made this really funny point that now I can't like really unsee when I go and watch those movies. And they kind of made this argument that like Jason literally is like the wrath of God coming, because he doesn't come until after like the first like joint smoked or the first like sex is teased. It's always raining and storming when he. He starts killing everybody. It's always lightning and rain when he comes. I'm like, man, yeah, he's like, that is a that's really funny. I can't unsee it now.
Yeah, and the first two films in that series were great too. I mean, honestly, obviously, I feel like, a lot of younger folks don't even realize that Jason's not in the first film, except as a sort of a little throwaway, nothing of a character, but that but the first one, great film. The second one, Jason is scary as hell in that second movie, before the hockey mask shows up, and such again, such a good film. I mean, they held on for a little while. I think even the third one, which I got to see in the theater in 3D, was so
Oh,
excited about it.
wow.
Yeah, I'm an old man. Was a it was still a good scary flick. After that, they started to just again go so far downhill, and then they're just putting people in the film to be killed. They're not characters, they're fodder for somebody to be killed, and they want more creative kills, the more complicated, the more sort of blood splashing out. And I'm like, listen, I've seen that 100 times. You can pump all the red colored Karo syrup in through a machine in the world, it's not going to get more scary. We've seen all of that before, so I definitely respect somebody who's willing to write a good script, even for a slasher film, than I am somebody who's just going to pump a lot of blood through a rubber limb.
I agree completely, my friend. Like what was the last real good, besides the Demeter, what was the last real good horror movie that you got to check out? Anything good in the last couple of years?
There hasn't been much that has been, to my thought. I haven't seen the newer Halloween films, largely for the same reason I told you, is that I feel like, they've changed the concept of it so much, and I feel like it's disrespectful to the original. I hated what Rob Zombie did with them, unfortunately. I'm not a Rob Zombie fan. I know a lot of people are. For me, it just they don't work. So I guess I'm not really sure. I think The Cursed is probably the last cinematic horror film that I saw that I really thought was excellent. On the subject of Dracula, about 2 years ago, there was a film called The Invitation, which is it's not a bad movie. It got a really, really bad rap. I actually thought it was a really enjoyable. It kind of, I always said that it's like the movie version of those old gothic novels from the 1970s that always had like a woman in a gown running away from a spooky looking house. This is like a cinematic version of that. And I think, again, a lot of people didn't even realize that it was a Dracula movie. I thought it was good fun. I mean, not perfect by any means, but certainly really enjoyable. Didn't deserve to completely tank in theaters as it did. That happens a lot, not even a period piece. It was set, it's contemporary. I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but so I don't mind. I often look for things in movies that other people don't, and so I end up liking movies that a lot of people didn't like, and often I'm not as impressed with movies that everybody loves. So
I'm kind of going more that way. I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm actually, if a lot of people have seen it and are raving about it, it kind of turns me off from watching it for a while. But yeah, I mean, I haven't only a handful of movies I can really say in the last couple of years. I keep going back and searching like the old stuff, or I keep going back and searching like right now I'm kind of on a kick of finding like the old like Spanish black and white horror films and kind of delving back into those, because yeah, it's just like you said, it's just Scream movies and slasher movies that just kind of it's
yeah, I think it just
all
it's the
bang.
same thing. And you know what? I don't need to see another one for the next decade as another zombie movie. Zombie movies, you know what? I Dawn of the Dead scared the hell out of me, back in the 70s, and there were a couple of good movies that followed up on it, but then it felt like nobody made anything but zombie movies for 10 years,
Yeah,
It
no, I remember that. And then The Walking Dead came, and it was
Yeah.
just like, I'm done. I can't, like, just.
Yeah, I'm just like, listen, I need something that's different. I just need you to do something different. And after a while, they like, 28 Days Later, that's a phenomenal film,
That's a great movie.
stuff like that. But I also lean towards the supernatural. Like 28 Days Later, it's a medical, sort of a viral thing, and they did a great job with it. So I consider it an excellent film, but you always get a little extra boost from me when you do the supernatural thing. I think probably one of the best lines ever in a horror film in Dawn of the Dead is, the character, who says that, his grandfather told him that when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. What a phenomenally scary
Yeah.
line. And to be that sort of kernel of setup for this movie, I thought that was glorious.
No, I agree totally. And I didn't mind the Dawn of the Dead remake. That I thought that was pretty good as far as remakes go.
Yeah, it's actually not a bad film at all.
So, but like you said, yeah, zombies, it's kind of give it another 15 years and see what you can come up with.
Yeah, do something new or fresh, hopefully.
And I'm hoping, I mean, I know Del Toro's making a Frankenstein film, so we'll see. And I know there's I want to say, I can't think of his name right now. But the guy who wrote Saw, and he wrote the first two Insidious films. It's not James Wan. It's the Lee Wannell. That's
Oh,
it.
yeah, yes, Lee Waddle.
I believe he's making a Wolfman movie that's coming out next year. So we'll see.
Hearing this, and I know that they've gone through a lot of people. Writers have come and gone, actors have come and gone. I know Ryan Gosling was talking about doing the lead role, and I mean, there's a couple interviews where he's even talking about it, but it just keeps falling apart, which is a bummer because I would love to see something done
Would.
well, obviously. I thought that the 2010 Benicio del Toro Wolfman movie was great.
Me too.
Again, practical effects. That's an interesting one where, I was talking about the gore thing. I don't mind gore, but when it's n unnecessary and it just seems to be there because people expect it. And that's a film that did that because it's a universal horror film. The setup, it's a period film, again, beautifully done, and the setup for it was so good. And every time the Wolfman's on screen, they throw as much blood at the screen as they possibly can, and they want the most gruesome deaths. And to me, it took me out of the movie because I love the Universal classics. And one of the nice things about them is there was an era of innocence about them. And because I know you can make a good story without resorting to that. So there's a scene, I think it's like probably the first big Wolfman kill, where the claws come through the guy's neck and out of his mouth. And I was like, we don't have to see that. And it's just like, this basically just cuts out a chunk of the audience so that they can't see it at that point. Because now it's just so gory that, it's got to be a hard R-rated film. And I'm like, well, you know what? My mom loves monster movies, but I'm not going to make my mom sit through that kind of thing because that would disturb her. And, when you're remaking the class, you can go for a classic angle on it, and I think that would have been a smart movie to keep the gore, at least under control.
Yeah, or even so, or even like you said, if you really got to make that film, because the, you know what I mean, like, okay, have that the uncut version, have
Right.
the
Oh,
version,
yeah.
because yeah, there's one scene, and I love the film too, don't get me wrong, because even the music was very reminiscent of Coppola's Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula. So I was like, man, the music, the score was great, like
That
you
was
said,
Danny Elfman, and I got to tell you,
creepy.
he can do no wrong in my opinion. Danny Elfman's
I'm the same
amazing
way. I'm
composer.
the same way. That guy can just. Don't ever stop making scores, pal.
Yep, no, I mean, and I've been a fan of him since he was, the lead of Oingo Boingo, which I guess technically he still is, but phenomenal band, great music. They got great horror music when they were doing Oingo Boingo. I mean, Dead Man's Party, such a great song. But so yeah, it was always nice to see him. His composition was great right from the start, I think, when he first started working with Tim Burton, but it's just gotten better and better and better.
I'll never forget being a child. And there weren't superhero movies coming out every month back then. And when Tim Burton's Batman came out and I heard that music for the first time, like I still get goosebumps thinking about it, just seeing this epic superhero movie and being a kid and that music, it's like wow.
I remember waiting in line outside the theater to see it. Yeah, I've always been a big superhero fan too, and you know, it's funny to think about that point where a superhero movie was such an event because they were rare, and when they did come out, they were often terrible. So you had your real standouts. You know, you're the 1978 Superman, which is a spectacular film. You had, you know, the 1989 Batman, which was a great film. I'm not sure it's aged as well as I'd like it. You know, I mean, it's still, it looks a little weird these days, but even still, to think now, I can't even count how many Batman films there are. It's like, it's what a difference a couple of decades makes in terms of that culture.
I think once they hit a certain year, Batman movies just started coming out like every 2 years, and they haven't stopped.
I mean, and there have been some excellent ones,
I mean, I'll still watch them, but
a couple of real you know, duds, but some excellent ones along the way too. I thought the Batman, which just came out, was it last year? Was maybe more than that now, but I thought that was fantastic. You
me
know, I don't mind
too, me
dark
too.
and grim approach at all, especially for Batman.
Yeah, I dug it, and I'm actually eager to see where they take that. And I keep hearing rumors they're going to make one that kind of goes along with what James Gunn wants to do. So we're going to probably get two different Batmen in the next 3 years.
Yep.
We'll see what, like I said, I'll, you know, I mean, if they're good, I'll see them. But I like the take of the Batman. I thought it was cool. I like the whole year one grittiness to it, and I like how he made Gotham City look. I love Colin Farrell as the Penguin.
I can't even believe when I watch him on screen that that's Colin Farrell underneath all that makeup. That blows my mind.
You can tell he's having so much fun when he's in it though,
It's
because
probably one of the best
he was
prosthetic
cool.
makeup jobs I've ever seen in my life. If you
Yeah.
didn't know that that was a, you know, that was prosthetics, you would just believe this was just fat ugly mobster, you know?
Yeah, well, and it goes to show you, like, okay, like kind of going back to what you were talking about, like practical effects. Like, look what they made him look like. Imagine if they really wanted to put money and effort into like putting a guy in a suit to look like a scary monster.
Yeah.
They have the tools and the technology, because I like CGI, and I know it's got to be done. But I mean, come on, if you really want to.
CGI can be exquisite when it's done well. CGI, when it is used, you know, when you're one of the things I think that I watched a great show that explored this a little bit is one of the problems with CGI is that it gives you the ability to stretch reality way past anything reasonable and to show things that are extraordinary. And so people keep thinking, well, then I gotta do the biggest possible stunt or the craziest possible creature. But your brain is designed to perceive certain things and also to perceive things that are wrong. And the problem is that you know, these super crazy angles and like these big distended shots and huge hands coming out towards you where they extend the perspective on it to make it look bigger, but your brain rebels against that. So it can be incredibly done CGI, but if it's not smartly done, your brain immediately says that's not real. And it's funny because a lot of prosthetics and practical effects, these rubber suits and mechanical things, you can tell it's not real as in it's not alive, but your brain also sees that it's a real object on the screen and it compensates for that. So the practical effect ends up being more convincing, even if you know that the creature is unreal, than a incredibly realistic looking thing doing something that physics just doesn't allow for. And I think that's the reason that CGI fails as often as it does, because we see films every day with CGI that's not trying to stretch reality, and we never know that it's CGI because it looks perfect. And that's, I think, the failure of the, you know, of the modern film industry is they're always trying to push something to an extreme, but your brain's not looking for extremes. Your brain wants to see something believable and realistic, and that's why good CGI animation is outstanding, and it's only like literally like a breath of hair to get to bad CGI with the same amount of technology.
Absolutely. And like you said, bad once you're into a movie and you see bad CGI, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, it can take you right out of it.
Like some of these comic book movies that come out in the last couple of years, like I can't they were probably good movies, and the acting was really good, and the story was good, but there was a couple of parts where the CGI was here, and it's like you said, it just takes you right out of the film, and you can't really find your way back in.
I
And
think they get
CGI
away.
just it ages so quick.
I think they get away with it a little bit more in comic book movies because comic books, in general, have a more distended reality. They're not, they don't, you know, we who read comic books growing up aren't really expecting realism. And so we forgive it a lot more with that. But horror movies work best when they feel real. That's the thing.
Absolutely.
Horror movies, because something's not scary if you don't believe in it. You know, Superman, you know, punching a meteor, not realistic at all, but that's where the coolness of Superman comes in. But in a monster movie, you have to believe the monster's there or it stops being scary. And that's why, again, that's why I think in that context, you've got to be subtle and smart with your CGI. You can't go for, you know, everything's an explosion and everything's gigantic. And yeah, that definitely.
I mean, I'll take the guy in the alien suit in the original Alien versus like 3/4 of the alien movies I've seen in the last like couple of years. Like, you know, like the I forget what the last one was. It
I
wasn't the
stopped watching. I stopped watching them a while ago for the same reason, you know?
Yeah, like Alien and Aliens. These are all practical effects and guys in suits. And like you said, yeah, it's a guy in a suit, but it looks amazing. And like you said, your brain can accept it. I mean,
Yeah.
the last Alien movie I saw, it was just like.
Yeah, I ran out of patience with them after a while for the same reason too. You know, not only, you know, the effects just get progressively less convincing as time goes by, but also the plot lines, they're just a trying too hard now. And there's a point at which you should say, listen, squeezing money out of the franchise just for the purpose of squeezing money out of the franchise is never going to be effective. You're not going to come up with a good script if your entire purpose is just to say, alien movies are popular, let's make another one. No, you have to have a story that is worth telling. And if you say, hey, listen, I've got a great concept for an alien story, and I think that it is perfectly fits within the universe, you're probably going to get a good film out of it. But that's not what these people are doing. And that's such a shame too. You know, they're just saying, hey, we've got this IP sitting here on the desk and it hasn't made us any money this year, so let's get a film into production. Yeah, that's not a good formula for making successful movies. Certainly not for making good movies.
Well, I forget too. I think it was like Sony with Spider-Man. They had to make I think it was in their contract, like they had to make a Spider-Man movie within so many years, or they had to
Yep.
get the property back. So it's like, okay, no disrespect to Andrew Garfield. He's a fantastic actor, but that's why
Those
you get
were
basic Spider-Man
badly written movies. Andrew Garfield is
movies.
awesome, but they were bad movies, unfortunately.
They were bad movies, and like I said, I get into it all the time. My favorite is that first Amazing Spider-Man movie where it's like I'm glad they took a guy called the Lizard and just made him look like a reptilian man versus looking like a lizard, like a certain type of reptile. They just gave a guy scales and a tail. He looked awful. They didn't even put him in a lab coat. Come on.
I mean, the concept for the rhino was terrible. Like the revised Electro, I didn't like anything that they did with any of these villains, you know.
No, I didn't. It was terrible. I think even the Green Goblin looked like some like punk rock emo kid.
It's again, it kind of hurts my soul. I mean, I was a huge Spider-Man fan when I was a kid, and I like the Sam Raimi films, at least the first two. You know, I don't think they're perfect. I think people kind of like build them up a little bit more than they're, but even still, they're excellent movies. The third one, of course, just dreadful. And again, another one that was a victim of tremendously overused CGI, the third film by far. So.
We are in total agreement, and so I didn't get a chance to read it yet. But this came out what September 20th.
Just this last October, this last fall, and so yep, that one was. So that was a funny story. So I had already designed the cover for the book, and Neil had, you know, said to me, if you're going to do the werewolf book, promise me the cover. And I said to him, listen, I absolutely want to give you the cover of the book, but I've also already designed the cover, and I really, really like it. And I couldn't find a way to like sort of, you know, get the in between the two. And I finally said, you know what? I'm going to do a special edition with a slip cover. Yep. So that's
There's
the sort of
come.
the standard cover of the book. And then Neil had this gorgeous illustration, and I, you know, said, you know, let's do a slip cover. And I kind of muted it. I tried to make it look like an old fashioned. I wanted to make it look like a classic horror film and everything. So I used the kind of retro font and everything else, and had so much fun doing that.
Well, I can't, like I said, I can't wait to read it, and I was looking up to it, and this is actually, is that, do you, is this still This is still available on ghostboypress.com.
The hardcover is still available. That's a limited edition, so there's only about 100 of them. A standard edition will be available a little bit later this year. This will be a standard paperback and a bit less expensive as well.
I have number five.
Number five, yeah, you know what? That came from Neil's stock. I can tell already. Yeah, I had to give Neil a few copies, and I wanted to give him the low numbers on there. So,
Well, thank you, Neil.
yeah.
But like I said, I can't wait to read it. And I've never heard of this actual legend. If you kind of get into it, and I'm gonna
You know, the
book.
funny thing is, I'm going to tell you right now, yeah, you have. You just don't realize it. So the
Elser.
two films based on it. Actually, there's a couple more, but there's two specific ones. One is Brotherhood of the Wolf,
Yep. Okay. I
the
love
story.
that movie.
Yep. That's a great example of a movie which I think that is so much fun as a movie, but there was one huge disappointment for me. I had to track that movie down because that didn't play around very much when it came
Same
out.
here. Same
Here it
here.
is here. I had to drive up to Boston to find a little theater that was playing this movie and went there, sat through the whole movie. I thought it was so cool, but the reveal of what the creature was. Here's this werewolf legend that I have loved for years and years and years. And so the re reveal of it was a big disappointment. I still love the film. It's a phenomenal movie, but it's like waking up Christmas morning and like, you know, opening your presents and, you know, instead of getting like a new video game, you get a box of socks. You know, so unfortunately that colored my view of that one a little bit. But interestingly enough, you probably wouldn't have caught it because they only make a couple of really vague references to it. But The Cursed, the movie The Cursed we were just talking about, the lead character there, Boyd Holbrook's character, talks about the fact that he was stationed in Jevodon and that this thing had been rampaging there. And he's wondering now if it's the same curse that is, you know, sort of come to this other area of France and everything. So that's actually inspired by the Beast of Jevodon as well, which if, you know, for the folks out there who are not aware of it, this is a true story of a werewolf, or rather a creature, which was described by the people who spotted it and survived as like a wolf, yet not a wolf, that terrorized South Central France for about 3 years in the late 1700s, from 1764 to 1767, killed over 100 people. And it was such an epidemic of deaths by this unknown creature. And as I say, seemed unstoppable. People shot it. It would get back up again. The king, King Louis XIV, actually ended up sending troops to the section of France to try to kill the thing. They were never successful in taking it down again. We had soldiers who shot it, and the thing would get up and it would run away again, over and over and over again, until finally, in the summer of 1767, it was killed by a farmer using a blessed bullet, you know, which they say was made from a medal of the Virgin Mary that was formed down into a bullet and finally killed the thing. That's how the story goes, at least. But what's amazing about it is that it really happened. This is a real creature. The documentation of all his various victims. There are books printed that have the church records when because it became a huge thing with the church. All the clergy were saying that it was a scourge from God sent to punish people for being idolaters. It was a huge scandal for the king at the time, who was trying to institute this age of reason. And all of a sudden, people are running around suggesting that there's a werewolf killing people in, you know, sort of the rural mountains of France. And it was an amazing event. The newspaper stories made it all the way across Europe. Even so few in America ran the story. And I've been fascinated by it since I was, you know, probably, you know, 15 or 16 years old and first discovered it. So that had to be the subject of my next book. And I decided I'd done Dracula. I was going to do basically the Wolfman. And then this coming October, I'll be heading to Germany to do a book on Frankenstein. So I'm going to do my trilogy of famous monsters.
I was gonna get to that, and I know I was gonna see if you wanted to talk more about, because you kind of allude to that in The Haunting of Dracula. You do a little
Yes.
bit at the end, and like I said, Frankenstein's monster is my favorite, so I'm gonna be pre-ordering that one because I gotta have that hardback when it comes out.
I'm very excited to do that one. So,
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, I wish I'm like, can I go with you?
yeah. Please be my guest. I
Can I
speak a little
carry
bit
your
German.
bag?
I can at least order it in a restaurant. So, yeah, about a few years back, back in 2018, I was in Germany researching a book on the legend of Sleepy Hollow, actually. And while I was there, that is kind of a funny story. I knew that being there, the documents that I was looking for were a long shot. And so I thought, if I'm going to go, I'm not coming back empty-handed. And I was, in a little town called Marburg that was maybe an hour or so north of Frankfurt. And I realized that I was within a fairly reasonable train journey to Eberstadt, which is where Castle Frankenstein is located. And I thought, on my last day there, I'm going to make a pilgrimage to Castle Frankenstein, because that way, at least when I come back, if I come back empty-handed, I've had one cool thing to have happen. So I did get to go and visit Castle Frankenstein. And at the time, I didn't have any particular reason. It was just for the fun of it. But I kept thinking, again, I do love the Frankenstein story. I love the Frankenstein monster. And how can I work that into a book? So I finally decided I was going to do it. So I'm going back to Castle Frankenstein. And then I'm spending a few days in Ingolstadt, which is where in the book the creature is actually created. So I'm looking very forward to that. And I think that's going to be great fun.
It sounds like it's going to be fun, and I think like was there already a teaser for that? Like it's we expecting this.
I've put up a couple of notations on Instagram and things like that about it, because I at first I wasn't sure if I was going to do it. I actually kind of put the word out there to ask if what people thought they would read it, because you never know. I mean, I'm not made of money. I can't publish books that nobody's going to read. And so a lot of people said, oh yeah, I would totally read that. And I finally just decided. I one evening I did a little bit of research into plane tickets, trying to find out an affordable plane ticket. Got a great deal on a plane ticket, and I said, all right, I'm going to Germany. That's got to be the way to go. So I never go on vacation unless I can hunt a monster.
That is so awesome. And like I said, I'm like obviously I'm looking forward to reading this. I cannot wait to start this book. And I can't I'm so looking forward to that one. What I mean, this is probably really far out. And I think was it last Halloween or maybe a couple years ago, you did a special on Jack the Ripper.
I did, yes. I had a show that on YouTube for a couple of years called Monday Night Monsters, and so we did a wonderful show on Jack the Ripper. It, I believe, to this day is our highest rated episode we ever
Okay.
did.
Is
And
there, do you think there'll ever be a talk of like the Hunting Jack the Ripper book in the future?
I've already designed the cover for it, honestly. I've wanted to do it for a while. It's kind of on my back burner, but it's one that I want to do, because part of for me, I don't like to write a book if I can't bring something new to the conversation. That's for me a really big thing. I mean, I don't want to just retread the information. Like Hunting Dracula, one of my great heroes and mentors in researching that was Professor Raymond McNally, who he and his partner Radu Florescu wrote the book In Search of Dracula back in the 70s, and they're the people who are credited with kind of like revealing to the world that Vlad III of Wallachia was the inspiration for Dracula. But I knew that I was in danger of just replicating his research, and I didn't want to do that. But he was a good friend, and I decided to dedicate the book to him and try to build on his research. And a big part of that was pushing back against this idea that the character of Vlad the Third, was not a big influence on Stoker. And so luckily, one of the things I was able to do is work with Dacre Stoker, who is the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker, and who's a sort of an expert in his ancestors' work. And he helped lead me to some great primary sources about the books that Stoker had in his notes and had in his research files and everything, and find references to Vlad that had not really been published before. So it was great. It was great. And it was really able to fun to be able to pull together the fact that even if his concept, Bram Stoker's concept for the vampire of the book, was really well established before he discovered this 15th century warlord, the identity that he ends up superimposing or sort of creating for his vampire was taken largely from the character of Vlad the Impaler. And so it was fun to be able to find these primary sources, find quotes about him in here, and realize that Stoker knew a lot more about Vlad Dracula than people had previously suspected. There are still people who really blow it out of proportion, who say that the entire concept for it is based on Vlad the Impaler, and that Vlad the Impaler drank blood and he did all these different things, and that's mostly hearsay. That's not true. But there's still a great deal of inspiration. And so for me, being able to bring that into it and really talk about that was a great deal of fun. It was fun to be able to connect the story of Lucy Westenra, the girl who's killed halfway through the book and becomes a vampire. She's a big part of the original novel. It's usually in most of the movies. Was at least likely inspired in part by a real New England legend of a woman named Mercy Brown, who died in 1892, several years before Dracula was published, and was exhumed as a vampire here in New England. I grew up in Rhode Island, so this was my local legend, and being able to connect it to Dracula was so much fun. So I feel like I brought something fresh to the conversation, and to me, that's the reason to write a book.
Well, like I said, that when I read it, I mean, it was all news to me. And like I said, I thought it was fascinating. I couldn't put the book down.
Well,
And
really glad to hear
oh,
that.
it was great. I loved it. I want to actually read it again at some point, but there's only so much time in the day and the days and the weeks. But the story of Brown, that's tackled. Do you talk about that in Vampires in New England,
I do,
right?
yeah. I actually, the very first book I ever wrote back when I was a dreadfully young and inexperienced writer was called Vampire Legends of Rhode Island. And because at that time, there were more vampire folk tales from Rhode Island than anywhere else in New England that we discovered. And another one of my mentors, a fellow named Michael Bell, who's an amazing folklorist and researcher, has since then discovered more than 80 cases throughout the Northeast of people who believed that vampires were stalking their family, mostly in the late 18th to the late 19th century, exhumed people, burned their bodies, cut out their hearts, etc. It was a very, very common folk practice here in New England. Well, common enough in any case. And again, I grew up with that kind of stuff. And so when I was in my 20s and I would tell people about these things, most people looked at me like I was from Mars. They had no idea what I was talking about. I mean, everybody knew their local ghost stories. Everybody knows about the witches of Salem. So I thought, why don't anybody, doesn't anybody know about the vampires of New England? So I wrote this very chintzy book. Please don't hunt it down because it's terrible, but it's called Vampire Legends of Rhode Island. And
I have seen the book, and I was tempted, because now I'm like, okay, because
please avoid
so far
it.
you're three for three with me, you know what I mean? Like,
I was a very, very green young writer, and it took me a while to perfect, or at least to improve my craft, I think. But it did pretty well. It did pretty well when it came out. I had a nice publisher out of Massachusetts who published it for me. It did pretty well. They asked me if I would do a follow-up. So I wrote a book called The Vampire Hunter's Guide to New England to expand the stories into the rest of New England. Most of those didn't make it into the public because of my publisher ending up selling their business to somebody who was a disaster. So several years after that, yeah, so my early publishing history is crazy. So several years after that, I got a phone call from another Cape Cod-based publisher, and they said, we've bought all the assets of my old publisher, which was called Covered Ridge Press. We've bought all their assets, including about 2,000 copies of your book, The Vampire Hunter's Guide to New England, and they're selling well because we're selling off the stock. And they said, we're selling well enough, we'd like to reprint it if we could. And I said, you know what? That's amazing. Thank you. But it's currently now a 10-year-old book. If you let me revise it, I will let you reprint it. And so they gave me a year to work on it, and that became Vampires of New England, which is the one that you have. So that's the revised follow-up to my original book. Actually has a little bit of material from all of them, some of my original illustrations, and it was wonderful to be able to get that out to the world.
and it's just, like I said, it's a super cool book. Like, I was so I've been I was very excited when you answered my messages and you were going to be on the show, and I was like, oh, I'm like really, I was kind of really freaking out. And I was telling a buddy of mine I work with, he's like a history guy, and I was telling him, I just finished reading this, and I was telling him all about it, and I was like, yeah, and it's, we earlier in the show we were talking about like really good period pieces that they just aren't making or can't make. There's a lot of stuff in here that could make some really, really great period piece horror movies if done correctly. I mean,
I'd love to see
I don't know why
somebody.
Hollywood doesn't track you down.
I'd love to see somebody, do one of these great New England legends and really turn it into a great historic period piece. Again, probably no one would go to see it, as we've established before.
Well,
But
we know three people that would see it. Two of them are right here. One of them would be Neil, and he'd go see it.
Neil would definitely go. So, interestingly enough, there is one film that I can't prove it, but I've always believed was inspired by our local legends. Have you ever seen a film from the 70s called Let's Scare Jessica to Death?
I've never seen it, but it's so funny you say that, because that movie's come up lately in like, hey, you would like it, like on Shudder. Hey, you'd like this movie. And I was like, I kind of want to see that. And literally the other day, that movie came up.
It's a fantastic film. It's what I was talking about right at the beginning. It's got no gore, very few special effects. It's a cheap, when I say cheap, it's a small budget film. It's not like a no budget film. I mean, it's got some good actors in it. The visuals are spectacular. It's the most atmospheric film ever. It's filmed in a little town that's actually only about a half an hour from where I am in Connecticut now, called Old Saybrook and Chester. These two little towns with beautiful old, like 19th century New England, houses, foggy lakes, autumn leaves, old cemeteries, and everything else. And it's basically cursed with that terrible title that makes it sound like every cheesy mid-70s movie, but it isn't at all. It's a sort of a ghost story, vampire story, with wonderful atmosphere, amazing score. The score is more ambient noise than it even is
Right.
music. There's some music in it, but it's so atmospheric. It's one of those movies, and I think you're going to know exactly what I mean, that if you watched it on a Tuesday afternoon, it probably won't affect you. But if you watched it like, around twilight on like one of those Sundays, when you're feeling lazy, when your mind is really receptive, it's so spooky. It's one of the most creepy movies. Stephen King actually raves about it, which is always nice to see. It's got a great cult following, but it's wonderful. It's a truly wonderful film. But when you see it, and I don't want to give away a whole lot of details about it, I think you'll understand what I say when I believe that it was inspired by real New England folklore because of aspects of the story, time frame and everything else. And so I feel like there's that one movie that kind of captures that feel.
Well, I can't, so like I'm not sure when this is going to air, but like right now we're getting ready for Super Bowl weekend and
Yes.
I don't watch the Super Bowl. So that's I think you just found out my Sunday night for me. And you're right, let's scare Jessica to death. It's almost like, okay, what's this a movie about? Like, what's this like a movie about a final girl? What is this?
Well, the funny thing is that the original, it went through several titles and several script iterations. Because, of course, being a nerd, I research everything about movies that I love. When they first pitched the idea, it was actually pitched as a comedy, which, it, by the way, is very much not. But it was pitched as a comedy, and the original title for the film was going to be called It Drinks Hippie Blood. Ridiculous. And it was going to be this zany vampire comedy, and they
Thank
went through.
God it didn't happen.
Yeah, they went through a couple of directors, and they ended up with a director named John Hancock, who's made a couple of good films. In fact, I think he directed Jaws too, strangely enough. But anyway, he had some good films to his name, and he got the script, and he said, "I will do this if you let me rewrite it and make it into an actual horror film." And the studio, I guess they'd already spent some money, and they said, "Sure, just go ahead and do it." And he wanted to just name it Jessica, who's the main character of the story. And the studio saw the script. They loved the script, but they said, "Jessica, it's such a boring name. Let's call it something cool. Everybody's making Don't Go in the Attic and Don't Look in the Basement and all these movies that were coming out at that time." And they were like, "How about Let's Scare Jessica to Death," which, by the way, has nothing to do with the story. But they made it. It's great. And I think I first saw it in like 1972 in a drive-in, and it has been one of my favorite horror films ever since.
Well, I'll definitely check it out. Like I said, I'm in the mood. I'm chopping for new horror movies because I'm in a drought right now, and I hate it. It's an awful feeling. There's really no. I think the only real movie on my list to really watch is like Oppenheimer.
Yes, yeah, which
I want to see
I need
it.
to be prepared before I see Oppenheimer, because that's going to be a downer. I know it is.
A 3.5 hour downer, I think.
Yeah, check out Jessica. Again, it's a quiet movie, it's a slow-moving movie, but it's a great slow burn. And it's just the actors in it are supernaturalistic. They don't feel like actors. The movie has this voyeuristic feel because the people feel so real in it that you feel like you're intruding on someone's life, which actually is really effective. And so again, I highly recommend it. I hope I'm not overbuilding it, but even still, I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, you said the key word, like I'm another guy too. I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older too, but the score is so important to a movie, and it was for so long it was just kind of taken for granted. You don't realize how important a score is until you see some of like these newer movies where the score is just like if it ain't the guy doing the Christopher Nolan movies, it's almost like garbage, or it's like some new auto tone,
This
like
one has
pop music.
The music in it is fairly minimalistic. Again, it has a the music itself has a wonderful sort of somber creepiness to it. A lot of it's just simple piano, work. Very, very quiet and understated, except in some tense moments where it builds up a little bit. But even when they build it up, it's often this dissonant sort of like it's like people banging on pipes and stuff like that. But what it reminds me of is one of the things that I was very lucky when I was growing up is that we lived in a couple of older Victorian houses, and old Victorian houses are always noisy, and there's always things creaking and things clanking and everything. And when you're alone in those houses, that's terrifying. It just, again, it just has that creepy effect. And they capture that sense with so much of the score here and this weird ambient soundtrack that they use, that it makes it feel like, you know how when things are really quiet, even just the sounds inside your ears can be disconcerting? That's what this movie feels like. And again, I feel bad because I'm so building it up. I hope it lives up to its reputation. But I've watched that movie probably twice a year for the last 40 years. So to me, it's a glorious film.
Well, whether you built it up too much or not, like it's good to have a feeling of being excited because now, like, I'm really excited to watch it and I'm gonna, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's on my Shutter subscription, but if not, I'll get a copy of it because I'm really fiending to look for something new and see something new, and especially like the older stuff. I'm more, I don't know, give me any more. It's like the 80s and before.
Yep. I'm that way too. We were talking about Spanish films earlier. I'm a huge fan of Paul Naschy, all the Waldemar
Oh yeah.
films. I
Yeah.
mean, they're so cheesy, but they're so good, all
They're
that
sure
kind of
good.
stuff.
They're
I
sure good.
recently became Facebook friends with Xandor Varkov, the guy who played Dracula in that old terrible, terrible 60s movie of Dracula versus Frankenstein.
Oh,
Remember the terrible film?
I do.
He's wearing literally like those dime store plastic fangs, but he's a nice fellow, and so it was kind of fun to become friends with him on Facebook. And he still sells merch from that cheesy old 60s movie, which is amazing. So
I said, Neil, I started being really good friends with Neil, I want to say probably like 2005. And ever since, because even though he's in Jersey and I'm in Delaware, he's only like an hour away. So I try and make it a point to like go up his house at least once a month. Before I became a dad, I'd stay all weekend, but now I can't really do that now.
adulthood sucks.
Nah, it's just different. You know what I mean? I love it, but I still go up and see him. And yeah, I have seen. He's got me turned on to so much stuff. I mean, I remember. You couldn't really get your hands on like good copies of Hammer films like in the early 2000s unless you had like an all region player,
Right.
and he had all that stuff. So I didn't really even get to see all these Hammer films until like 2006, 2007. I mean, they changed my life ever since I did see him. I think the like my favorite my one of my favorite movies is The Gorgon. So
Great film. Great
I
film.
love that
You know
movie.
what? Anything with Peter Cushing and anything with Christopher Lee, you've already sold me at that point, But you know what's funny? Talk about the like, being able to see these films, now that so many of them are out on DVD and Blu-ray and everything, is that it's awesome, but there is one downside to it. And I really noticed this with things like Frankenstein's Bloody Terror and all these movies that I watched on TV in the 70s or at drive-ins in the 70s when it was crappy film prints of them or video prints of them, and you couldn't see a lot of what was happening, and so your
Yeah.
imagination filled in the details. So you'd see, all those Waldemar Daninsky films, when the werewolf's on screen, all you see is a little bit of eyes and these big white teeth and everything else, and that was freaky. But when you see the makeup in like full Blu-ray, details, it becomes a lot less convincing. So I still really push for even at least DVDs, because the DVD still kind of preserves a little of the mystery. Man, the Blu-rays now, you see every scene and every zipper.
So one of my favorite Tim Burton films is Sleepy Hollow.
Yes.
And like I said, I love that film. I watch that film at least once a year. And to me, and like Neil would agree, Sleepy Hollow feels like Hammer made a Headless
Absolutely.
Horseman movie.
He even went inspired by Hammer. He even went for that bright, like red orange blood. He
Yeah.
wanted to look realistic because he wanted it to have that Hammer feel, which I just absolutely love that. I'll tell you, on the 20th anniversary of Sleepy Hollow's release, I actually got to watch it in on a big screen theater in Sleepy Hollow, which was
That
so
is
much fun.
amazing.
Yeah, so much
I'm
fun.
very jealous. I'm very jealous.
My Sleepy Hollow book came out on the 200th anniversary of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the original story. It was also the 70th anniversary of the Disney cartoon, and it was the 20th anniversary of the Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, all in 2019. So it was like a trifecta. So I got to put out the book when it was literally the anniversary of the three greatest versions of Sleepy Hollow ever. So that was great fun.
And like I said, I have a copy of it, but I never read the original Sleepy Hollow. Everything, like, it's good. I mean, he's one of my favorite, that's probably like my favorite, like, folk horror character. It's the Headless Horseman, but it all comes from that Disney cartoon.
It really does. And even Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow takes so much inspiration from it. There are scenes, there's sound cues and everything. You know, when Ichabod's riding across the bridge in Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow and he hears the frogs kind of saying like sounding like they're saying Ichabod, all taken from the Disney cartoon, which is phenomenal.
Oh,
Again,
it's fantastic.
such a great concept.
I even remember, like, I've never been able to find a copy of it since, but when I was a kid, my grandmother taped the Legend of Sleepy Hollow that had Jeff Goldblum in it.
Yes.
Remember
Yep.
that?
Yep.
And I used to watch that. Like, I literally watched that until the VCR tape broke and wore out.
It had the best DVD cover art or box art ever. It had that great picture of like the guy with the head, no head holding the glowing pumpkin and everything. And you know, it's a bummer about that film because I'm the same as you. You know, that came out in the 80s when I was a teenager and I watched it again and again and again because at the time it was really one of the only things you had. But it doesn't hold up well today, unfortunately. I wish it did.
I'm kind of glad I haven't seen it since like I said, the last time I saw the movie, I think I literally killed my VCR to probably weighed 100 pounds.
Yep, those things were like a giant brick.
I think I killed the VCR from watching it so many times. And yeah, I haven't seen it since, but I think what was it, Dick Buckus, who
Yeah,
was
Dick Butkus that had Meg Foster. You know, it had a couple of really great character actors in it, and Jeff Goldblum is great, and honestly, a great pick for Ichabod Crane. I mean, really is. But there are so many things that you know, again, as an adult going back and watching it, I just can't take. One is that the whole thing is set in winter and it's like heavy snowfall, which come on, this is the autumn story. It's the ultimate autumn story. So having it in winter it just doesn't feel right. It's very comedic, but like. They threw away almost everything of Irving's story and they just rewrite the whole thing from scratch and a lot of dumb humor. And unfortunately, like I say, you know, I hate to knock it because any version of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is close to my heart. And I did watch it so many times back then. But yeah, it's hard to get through now. It is really hard to get through now.
Well,
And you know, my big
I'll keep it the
gripe.
way it is in my mind.
Yeah, definitely. I would not recommend going back and watching it. The big gripe that I have with so many of the live action versions that have been made over the years is that number one, they're almost always aimed at children. Nobody until Tim Burton made it as a horror film ever.
Yeah.
They were always made for children. And if you're going to do The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, literally 50% of your effort should go into the final chase and the final scene with the Headless Horseman because that is the money shot. But usually it's a throwaway. In all these old films, it's a throwaway. I mean, it's badly shot, or it only takes a few moments, or the pumpkin looks fake, or there's just so many things like that. In 1999, when Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow came out, they did a TV film also based on it that was a live action film, and they put so much effort into it. I mean, it looks historically accurate. I mean, it really does. And again, then you get to that final scene with the Headless Horseman, and it's such a huge letdown because they just did it cheaply. And if they had put half of the effort of their budget into getting that done and made that a scary sequence, the movie would have been saved. But that kind of stuff always bums me because, yeah, why are you watching The Legend of Sleepy Hollow? It's for the Headless Horseman. And so
Right,
you
and
better.
like you said, that scene, that part of the story, I mean, that's your King Kong on top of the Empire State Building moment.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Yeah.
right. And I actually, so again, like, I kind of discovered you in the last year or so. I I can't wait to get my hands on a copy of that
Like
because
I say, I'll be sending a copy along. I hope you'll
oh.
like it. It actually has, if you haven't read it, it actually has the entire original Washington Irving story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, in it. Because my original concept when I wrote the book was to write an annotated version of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, because like with the other things I was talking about, because so many of the characters from it were based on real historical people. And I just thought, you know, I'd always loved that story. It'd be fun to write an annotated edition. And while writing the book, I stumbled across a piece of information suggesting that the Headless Horseman himself was probably based on a real incident with a Hessian soldier who was decapitated. And I thought, well, that's really cool. So I did some research into it, and there was no information on who this Hessian soldier had been, but he was killed just a few miles outside of Sleepy Hollow on, and this is crazy, he was killed on November 1st, All Hallows Day, 1776. And I was like, oh, how can you go wrong with this? Literally,
Yeah,
killed a few miles
absolutely.
away from Sleepy Hollow, basically on Halloween, you know?
Yeah.
And so I approached every Irving scholar I could find, and I said, so what do we know about this decapitated Hessian soldier? And they said, nothing. It's literally, there's no records here in America for who this guy is. So I hunted and I hunted. I found some Hessian records in a Michigan university, didn't have what I needed. So that's how I ended up in Germany, in the Hessian archives in Marburg, Germany, looking for the military records for this soldier who was killed there, and I tracked him down.
That is, like I said, that's amazing. And that's like, you know what I mean? It just gets, like, I can't wait to get my hands on it. That's like incredible. That's like
Yeah,
blowing my
that was the real glory shot right there, because that's probably the one that I'll never replicate. You know, actually finding this guy was the one that, you know, I mean, again, I've had a lot of fun writing these books, but those moments where you can really find a new piece of research, that's something that is a once in a lifetime. So I'm pretty proud of that one.
Well, you should be. And like I said, just off this interview and just what I see, you know, just what I have been reading. I mean, I hope people realize that like the amount of stuff, the amount you go through, yeah, you're traveling and it's fun, but the amount of work you're putting in to, like you said, add new things to these stories that people may have heard. That, you know what I mean? You're not regurgitating, you're bringing something new to these stories. You're putting the work in, my man. This is fantastic stuff.
You know, a few years back, I just decided that if I, you know, I mean, I'm not getting any younger, and I had decided, it was actually while writing the Sleepy Hollow book, you know, when I first realized that there was nothing, you know, that I couldn't find those records here in the States, and you know, I did a little research and I found out about this Hessian archive in Marburg, and I said, well, that was the end of that. Obviously, I'm not going to Germany. And then I went, but why not? And that was a real sort of an epiphany moment too. And you know, again, many years ago, I had gone to Transylvania, but I hadn't really traveled significantly since then. And that was the moment where I said, you know, I think every year I'm going to plan a trip to go find a monster. And so it kind of became my life's ambition, is to, you know, hunt down the famous monsters of the world. And so far, it's been pretty fun. I mean, again, I can't say that I'm the last word on any of these things, you know, but I like to feel that at the very least I'm finding some new angle to approach it from. And if I can demonstrate to people that these amazing stories have real history behind them, to me, that's worth it. You know, it's worth everything.
All this talk, I can't wait to read your next book. I wish him
That's gonna it's a little ways off. That's gonna be October of 25, but hopefully I'll survive that long. That's the plan.
we got some we got some I got some stuff to hold me over,
All
so
right.
I can make it. I'll try and make it at least. And like I said, on that note, sir, I'll leave you be. I know you got things to do.
I got a super early morning, I can tell you that. I got to drive. I got to be up at 5:30 to drive to New Haven. Not looking forward to that one, but that's the nature of work sometimes. So, hey, it's been great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, Christopher, thank you so much. Like I said, Christopher Rondina, everyone. Hopefully we'll get more works in 2025. Searching Frankenstein. Go to
All
Ghost.
right, if I plug my website.
Go, please.
Because my books, that's the other thing, is I self-publish now, which I would never go back from. It's been such a joy to self-publish. And so if anybody's looking for my books, you're looking for ghostboypress.com. So that's where you can find exclusive. Every book is signed by me. And if you're lucky, you might even get one of the limited editions.
There you go. Happy to say I got one.
Once again, Bruce, thank you so much for having me on. It was a joy.
Oh man, the like I said, the thank you so much for doing this, Christopher. And like I said, good luck. Be safe in your travels. And thank you again from the Marvel of Horror. Check us out on the Marvel of Horror podcast on YouTube. We're on Spotify as well. Like, subscribe, and apparently now we can do Zoom. So if you're not
Yep.
from Delaware and you want to be on, I'd love to have you. And Christopher, man, when this even before if the book don't come out, you want to come back on, please message me. But when Frankenstein searching Hunting Frankenstein comes out, please come back on. I'd actually talk to you for a couple more hours if I thought
I
my
know it'd be great fun.
memory.
Anytime you want to talk monsters, you let me know.